Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara,
and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Five minutes after 8 on a Monday, 16 July. My ex-wife's birthday is tomorrow. Susan Lovely. Joining me, not so lovely, Alex Hollings from, I think, Georgia. Alex, good morning. How are you?
Not bad, man. I'm lovely sometimes. You know, I have my moments.
Let's not go down that road. I was media bashing a little while ago, okay? And so I want to play for you a little audio cut, a little audio clip, if you will. And I want to get your thoughts on, you pay attention to news headlines, I think, over the weekend, yes?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so let me play this little audio clip, and you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, that was my phone call to you that went to voicemail that just hung up. So, anyway, that was my phone.
Oh, gotcha, gotcha.
Yeah, anyway. Okay, so 24 seconds of audio from President Trump, okay? Here's what he actually said, and then we're going to talk about what the media went hysterical about. So here it is, and it's in.
I have a suspicion I already know what this is, but I'm ready.
All right, here you go.
Well, I think we have a lot of foes. I think the European Union is a foe, what they do to us in trade. Now, you wouldn't think of the European Union, but they're a foe. Russia's a foe in certain respects. China's a foe economically, certainly. They're a foe. But that doesn't mean they're bad. It doesn't mean anything. It means that they're competitors. They want to do well, and we want to do well.
Okay, so when you hear the whole little segment, it's a little bit different than Trump calls Europe a foe. Although I guess as a journalist, you could report that as factually correct. I would say that in terms of somebody that's interested in the truth, it lacks its broader context. Am I being fair or unfair?
You're being completely fair, but this is part of the problem with modern media. People tend to think that bias is something that's conspicuous. You know, people tend to think that, like, you know, Fox News is conservative, CNN tends to be liberal, and it's really easy to tell if you're paying attention. That's not really the case. A lot of times bias is through word choice. We're just like you're saying, you're being factually accurate, but you're using intentional word decisions, like words that have a certain, you know, people perceive words differently, you know, so depending on the language that you choose to use, you can kind of influence the way someone reads a headline or a story. And while no one could go in there and say that this is factually inaccurate, the way that you presented it was loaded, you know. And that's what you saw in the headlines about this. All the headlines were, Trump says the European Union's a foe, blames U.S. foreign policy on bad Russian relations, and heads into a meeting with Vladimir Putin. You know, and so every headline you see, you know, across international outlets as well, BBC, you know, things like that, you see this presentation of the story being that Donald Trump presented the European Union as worse than Russia, as worse than China, you know, when in reality, to be honest with you, I do still have a bit of an issue with him kind of putting them all on the same playing field, all on a level footing, because they're not. Russia and China are far larger foes, both, you know, diplomatically, economically, than, you know, the European Union is. So I do have a bit of an issue with that. But the way it's presented was intentionally infuriating, you know, because Ring drives traffic so much better than anything else.
Okay, I want to ask you about that because I want to read you an email because I was talking about this. And somebody who listens, who's a smart guy, former Marine, officer, don't hold that against him, and he wrote this about foes, all right? So he writes a couple paragraphs about, I'll read you the whole thing. Foes, period, period, period. And that is where the clickbait stops and the resistance starts. I watched the CBS coverage this morning, and the discussion was all about sowing doubt about Trump's actions. They ignore all of the actions that he has taken against Russia. How many times have you heard mention of the two Tomahawk strikes against Syrian bases where Russian troops were located? That's a pretty effing serious poke in the eye, diplomatically speaking. How about the Russian mercenary army that was annihilated? How about calling out Germany for their unilateral pipeline deal with Putin? We have yet to see a shred of evidence that supports the Russian collusion conspiracy theory, which what has already been exposed as an invention of John Podesta and Hillary Rodham Clinton's campaign on the day after the election. However, the mainstream media continues to push the narrative. Now, let me put a little footnote there. There's no question about Russian intervention. The question is about, was there collusion in the intervention? Okay, so anyway, that's my own footnote. Last paragraph that I want to... Okay, last paragraph, and then I'll cede the floor to you. The honorable man from Georgia. It's not all, and all, the word all is caps, about clicks. Okay, now, so remember that. It's not all about clicks. Yes, they are important, and they drive a lot of what they do, but there are no clicks involved when the highest-ranking faces of CBS News are sitting around the table on the air undercutting what Trump is doing. Now, I said I vehemently disagree with that. Okay? I vehemently disagree with that. Okay, hold, Alex, hold on. The president and Vladimir Putin just walked. I just want to take a few minutes of their press conference, and we'll talk about that too, okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
And business-like atmosphere, I think we can call it a success and a very fruitful round of negotiations. We carefully analyzed the current status, the present and the future of the Russia-United States relationship, key issues of the global agenda. It's quite clear to everyone that the bilateral relationship are going through a complicated stage, and yet those impediments, the current tension, the tense atmosphere, essentially have no solid reason behind it. The Cold War is a thing of past. The era of acute ideological confrontation of the two countries is a thing of a remote past, is a vestige of the past. The situation of the world changed dramatically. Today, both Russia and the United States face a whole new set of challenges. Those include a dangerous maladjustment of mechanisms for maintaining international security and stability, regional crises, the creeping threats of terrorism and transnational crime. It's the snowballing problems in the economy, environmental risks, and other sets of challenges. We can only cope with these challenges if we join the ranks and work together. Hopefully, we will reach this understanding with our American partners. Today's negotiations reflected our joint wish with President Trump to redress this negative situation in the bilateral relationship. Outline the first steps for improving this relationship to restore the acceptable level of trust and going back to the previous level of interaction on all mutual interest issues. As major nuclear powers, we bear special responsibility for maintaining international security. Vital, and we mentioned this during the negotiations, it's crucial that we fine-tune the dialogue on strategic stability and global security and non-proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. We submitted our American colleagues a note with a number of specific suggestions. We believe it necessary to work together further on to interact on the disarmament agenda, military and technical cooperation. This includes the extension of the strategic offensive arms limitation treaty. It's the dangerous situation with the global American anti-missile defense system. It's the implementation issues with the INF treaty. And of course, the agenda of non-placement of weapons in space. We favor the continued cooperation in counterterrorism and maintaining cybersecurity. And I'd like to point out specifically that our special services are cooperating quite successfully together. The most recent example is their operational cooperation within the recently concluded World Football Cup. In general, The contacts among the special services should be put to a system-wide basis, should be brought to a systemic framework. I reminded President Trump about the suggestion to re-establish the working group on anti-terrorism. We also mentioned a plethora of regional crises. It's not always that our postures dovetail exactly, and yet the overlapping and mutual interests abound. We have to look for points of contact and interact closer in a variety of international fora.
Okay, this is Vladimir Putin, so everybody knows. And so what I want to do is take his initial statement, President Trump's initial statement, and I've got my fingers crossed, and I'm already wincing, bracing for President Trump and what he's going to say, but I'm hopeful, okay? I'm hopeful. So as soon as we do that, and we'll get Alex's thoughts on what both of us have heard. So here we go.
Act proactively and take assumed leadership in this issue and organize the interaction to overcome humanitarian crisis and help Syrian refugees to go back to their homes. In order to accomplish this level of successful cooperation in Syria, we have all the required components. Let me remind you that both Russian and American military acquired a useful experience of coordination of their action, established the operational channels of communication, which permitted to avoid dangerous incidents and unintentional collisions in the air and in the ground. Also, crushing terrorists in the southwest of Syria, the south of Syria, should be brought to the full compliance with the Treaty of 1974 about the separation of forces, about separation of forces of Israel and Syria. This will bring peace to Golan Heights and bring a more peaceful relationship between Syria and Israel, and also to provide security of the State of Israel. Mr. President paid special attention to the issue during today's negotiations, and I would like to confirm that Russia is interested in this development and this will act accordingly. Thus far, we will make a step toward creating a lasting peace in compliance with the respective resolutions of the Security Council, for instance, the Resolution 338. We're glad that the Korean Peninsula issue is starting to resolve. To a great extent, it was possible thanks to the personal engagement of President Trump, who opted for dialogue instead of confrontation. We also mentioned our concern about the withdrawal of the United States from the JCPOA. Well, the U.S., our U.S. counterparts are aware of our posture. Let me remind you that thanks to the Iranian nuclear deal, Iran became the most controlled country in the world. It's submitted to the control of IAEA. It effectively ensures the exclusively peaceful nature of Iranian nuclear program and strengthens the non-proliferation regime. While we discussed the internal Ukrainian crisis, we paid special attention to the bona fide implementation of Minsk agreements by Kiev. At the same time, the United States could be more decisive in nudging the Ukrainian leadership and encourage it to work actively in this. We paid more attention to economic ties and economic cooperation. It's clear that both countries, the businesses of both countries, are interested in this. American delegation was one of the largest delegations on the St. Petersburg Economic Forum. It featured over 500 representatives of American businesses.
For the love of God, Vlad, wrap it up. This is like the Oscars. It keeps going. What the hell?
And President Trump, we agreed to create a high-level working group that would bring together captains of Russian and American business. After all, entrepreneurs and businessmen know better how to articulate this successful business cooperation. We'll let them think and make their proposals and suggestions in this regard. Once again, President Trump mentioned the issue of the so-called interference of Russia in the American elections, and I had to reiterate things I said several times, including during our personal contacts, that the Russian state has never interfered and is not going to interfere into internal American affairs, including election process. Any specific material, if such things arise, we are ready to analyze together. For instance, we can analyze them through the Joint Working Group on Cybersecurity, the establishment of which we discussed during our previous contacts. And clearly, it's past time we restore our cooperation in the cultural area, in the humanitarian area. As far as, I think you know that recently we hosted the American Congressman delegation, and now it's perceived and portrayed almost as a historic event, although it should have been just a current affair, just business as usual. And in this regard, we mentioned this proposal to the President. We have to think about the practicalities of our cooperation, but also about the rationale, the underlying logic of it. And we have to engage experts on bilateral relationship who know history and the background of our relationship. The idea is to create an expert council that would include political scientists, prominent diplomats and former military experts in both countries who would look for points of contact between two countries, that would look for ways on putting the relationship on the trajectory of growth. In general, we are glad with the outcome of our first full-scale meeting, because previously we only had a chance to talk briefly on international fora. We had a good conversation with President Trump, and I hope that we start to understand each other better, and I'm grateful to Donald for it. Clearly, there are some challenges left when we were not able to clear all the backlog, but I think that we made the first important step in this direction. And in conclusion, I want to point out that this atmosphere of cooperation is something that we are especially grateful for to our Finnish hosts. We're grateful for Finnish people and Finnish leadership for what they've done. I know that we've caused some inconvenience to Finland, and we apologize for it. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And handshake between the
Thank
two
you.
Men.
I have just concluded a meeting with President Putin on a wide range of critical issues for both of our countries. We had direct, open, deeply productive dialogue. Went very well. Before I begin, I want to thank President Niinistö of Finland for graciously hosting today's summit. President Putin and I were saying how lovely it was and what a great job they did. I also want to congratulate Russia and President Putin for having done such an excellent job in hosting the World Cup. It was really one of the best ever. And your team also did very well. It was a great job. I'm here today to continue the proud tradition of bold American diplomacy. From the earliest days of our republic, American leaders have understood that diplomacy and engagement is preferable to conflict and hostility. A productive dialogue is not only good for the United States and good for Russia, but it is good for the world. The disagreements between our two countries are well known, and President Putin and I discussed them at length today. But if we're going to solve many of the problems facing our world, then we're going to have to find ways to cooperate in pursuit of shared interests. Too often in both recent past and long ago, we have seen the consequences when diplomacy is left on the table. We have also seen the benefits of cooperation. In the last century, our nations fought alongside one another in the Second World War. Even during the tensions of the Cold War, when the world looked much different than it does today, the United States and Russia were able to maintain a strong dialogue. But our relationship has never been worse than it is now. However, that changed as of about 4 hours ago. I really believe that. Nothing would be easier politically than to refuse to meet, to refuse to engage, but that would not accomplish anything. As president, I cannot make decisions on foreign policy in a futile effort to appease partisan critics or the media or Democrats who want to do nothing but resist and obstruct. Constructive dialogue between the United States and Russia afford the opportunity to open new pathways toward peace and stability in our world. I would rather take a political risk in pursuit of peace than to risk peace in pursuit of politics. As president, I will always put what is best for America and what is best for the American people. During today's meeting, I addressed directly with President Putin the issue of Russian interference in our elections. I felt this was a message best delivered in person, spent a great deal of time talking about it, and President Putin may very well want to address it, and very strongly, because he feels very strongly about it, and he has an interesting idea. We also discussed one of the most critical challenges facing humanity, nuclear proliferation. I provided an update on my meeting last month with Chairman Kim on the denuclearization of North Korea. And after today, I am very sure that President Putin and Russia want very much to end that problem, going to work with us, and I appreciate that commitment. The President and I also discussed the scourge of radical Islamic terrorism. Both Russia and the United States have suffered horrific terrorist attacks, and we have agreed to maintain open communication between our security agencies to protect our citizens from this global menace. Last year, we told Russia about a planned attack in St. Petersburg, and they were able to stop it cold. They found them. They stopped them. There was no doubt about it. I appreciated President Putin's phone call afterwards to thank me. I also emphasized the importance of placing pressure on Iran to halt its nuclear ambitions and to stop its campaign of violence throughout the area, throughout the Middle East. As we discussed at length, the crisis in Syria is a complex one. Cooperation between our two countries has the potential to save hundreds of thousands of lives. I also made clear that the United States will not allow Iran to benefit from our successful campaign against ISIS. We have just about eradicated ISIS in the area. We also agreed that representatives from our national security councils we'll meet to follow up on all of the issues we addressed today and to continue the progress we have started right here in Helsinki. Today's meeting is only the beginning of a longer process, but we have taken the first steps toward a brighter future and one with a strong dialogue and a lot of thought. Our expectations are grounded in realism, but our hopes are grounded in America's desire for friendship, cooperation, and peace. And I think I can speak on behalf of Russia when I say that also. President Putin, I want to thank you again for joining me for these important discussions and for advancing open dialogue between Russia and the United States. Our meeting carries on a long tradition of diplomacy between Russia, the United States, for the greater good of all. And this was a very constructive day. This was a very constructive few hours that we spent together. It's in the interest of both of our countries to continue our conversation, and we have agreed to do so. I'm sure we'll be meeting again in the future, often, and hopefully we will solve every one of the problems that we discussed today. So, again, President Putin, thank you very much.
All right, so there you have two opening statements, and they'll continue their media event. Alex, what'd you think?
Oh, man. You ever sit in a meeting with somebody and just know they're full of shit, and you're trying really hard not to laugh as they're talking. As Vladimir Putin was going through his spiel, I literally was walking around my office chuckling to myself. It's like when somebody knows they're in trouble when the police arrive, so they suddenly go and become like the ambassador to law enforcement for the group. You know? I can poke holes and, you know, I started taking notes maybe halfway through his statements, and so much of it is not based in reality. Like, we can start with him talking about how he spoke to Trump about making sure that they don't put weapons in space. You know, this has been a big Russian talking point ever since Trump announced that he wanted to establish a space force. Again, Putin failed to kind of mention the fact that Russia has had a space-specific military branch set up since 2015, and that's just the most recent iteration. They actually had space-specific military branches dating back to the 50s and 60s. And they closed down every so often because of funding, and then they're reopened. Most recently, they reopened in 2015, the same year China launched their own space-specific branch of the military. On top of that, Russia just on Friday announced a new electronic warfare aircraft that they're building that specifically targets enemy military satellites in orbit, as well as, according to them, a whole slew of other things that it's theoretically capable of, including jamming all communications, shutting down. Based on the claims, it sounds like a flying electromagnetic pulse. It's going to shut down anti-aircraft arrays and so forth. Russia is actively working to establish weapon systems that can counteract America's geostationary presence, our global orbital presence. And then he's going to go and give a speech on Monday saying that I spoke to President Trump about making sure we keep weapons out of space.
Well, I think what he meant to say was keeping American weapons out of space, right? Because
how do we know
Russians are lying? Because their lips are moving.
Because they're talking.
Exactly.
And we can move on to the START Treaty, you know, where he's emphasizing the importance of maintaining and renewing the START Treaty. The United States hasn't deployed a new ICBM in decades. Russia deployed new ones, the RS-28 Sarmat, last year. All right, this is quite possibly one of the most powerful nuclear weapons on the planet. It uses, you know, a mirrored warhead, so it can deploy multiple warheads with a combined total of about 50 megatons, which just so happens to be the largest nuclear weapon ever tested. We've never detonated a larger nuclear explosion than 50 megatons. Of course, that was Russia that did that. Their new nuclear ICBM has that power, and that's not even the most powerful nuclear weapon that they have in their arsenal. The Status 6 is like a submersible drone with a 100 megaton yield. Russia is actively developing new and more powerful nuclear weapons while Vladimir Putin is giving this speech about how we need to reduce our nuclear weapons and seek peace. You know, just like their concerns about space, again, it's not we need to, it's America needs to reduce. You know, I will give him credit for this, though. The idea of dialogue instead of confrontation is, I think, the thing that the American media has ignored and forgotten about. When Donald Trump, he has a point when he says, it doesn't matter what I do, people are going to say I love Russia.
Right.
You know? Just like when it came to speaking with Kim Jong-un in North Korea, and people were arguing, you're going to legitimize his rule. He doesn't deserve to speak to world leaders. The guy's got nuclear weapons. We need to have a conversation with him. If the options are war or dialogue, a president's responsibility is to engage in dialogue.
Well,
and that's exactly what he's doing in Russia. I'll give him credit for that.
Well, I said this as the father of two infantry Marines. If you have to go to war, you better have exhausted all other possibilities. And so I think this is better business. I mean, we're talking now, and we could say, well, we're not making much progress, and that's infinitely better than last summer, which was what, the Hawaii civil defense drill gone wrong. It was
exactly.
It was North Korea shooting ICBMs over Japan like they were a set of goalposts, you know. And so I Vladimir Putin is a bad actor, okay? And again, what does Putin seek? I think that it's pretty accurate to say Putin views the dismemberment of the Soviet Union as one of the greatest catastrophes of the 20th century. He is looking,
I don't think you could be more right about that. You're 100% on
right. Target. He's looking to restore the pride and prestige and the power of Russia, right? In some kind of shadow of the Soviet Union. But that's what he's looking. So today, he wins. But what does the United States get? The United States, the world is better when the United States gets Russia to rein in its military peace to develop its economic peace. Russia is a European nation, okay? It doesn't need to go down this road of threats and Cold War. It does so, in my opinion, so Putin can sustain his dictatorship. Because if you begin to get too close to the West, then we have to go down the democracy trail again. And that doesn't turn out well.
The West is a tenet of his leadership. You know, he scares the Russian people with the boogeyman that is the United States and Western powers and this great Western conspiracy against Russia. You know, it's part of how he maintains such a high approval rating among the Russian people, aside from fear. But part of how he maintains such a high approval rating is he creates this, like, this idea of a contested Russia.
Right.
Of a powerful Russia that's at this top tier level, which they're really not. Their rhetoric keeps them at that top tier level. The fact that they're very aggressive keeps them at that top tier level of threats we need to consider. Economically, they couldn't afford to go to war with the United States. What they could afford to do, though, is lots and lots of damage in a Bond villain style way. In a I don't care what happens to me sort of way. So we have to keep an eye on them. But Russia is able to stay there in large part because Vladimir Putin markets himself as the champion for Russia against this great Western conspiracy, which is why it's hilarious to hear him go and stand next to Donald Trump and talk as though the United States is this bullying power that Russia is trying to mitigate.
Right.
It's infuriating to a certain degree.
So how do you think the president did? First of all, I don't think he made any, like,
ad-libs, man. He was on script.
He was. Look, I kept waiting for him to go off script and do a little ad-libbing. Now, the Q&A piece is a little bit more problematic for the president. But on his opening statement, I think that was about as clipped as I've ever seen D. Trump be.
You know, and I have to wonder, I'd imagine a lot of those statements were written prior to the meeting and then kind of like mad libbed together. We talked about this at that sentence. We talked about that. He did venture off, as I was taking the note, oh, my God, Trump did no ad-libbing. Ventured off a little bit, it sounded like, but just in the interest of custom and courtesy, you know, saying that this was a really good meeting and I'm glad that we did it and hopefully we can solve all of our problems.
I want to get your opinion on... The President of the United States is going to meet with the President of Russia. And the Justice Department unveils a indictment against 14 Russian intelligence officers. Now, we're sitting there in the Justice Department. When should we do this? Do you think we should, like, you know, bomb this on the President as he's en route? To me, that's a little. The timing of that's a little bit curious. Are we here going to set the stage for the president's meeting with Putin, or might we wait till Tuesday or Wednesday after that meeting's done to unleash this? Is there anything that's driving us to do this on the Friday before he meets with the president of Russia? I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
I could play devil's advocate on this one to a certain degree. I would argue that by releasing that information ahead of the meeting, you, number one, can, to a certain extent, try to force the president's hand into addressing this topic.
Right.
You also could theoretically delegitimize some of his position when he's talking about trying to improve relations with Russia. However, I'd argue it might actually do more damage if you wait until after Trump delivers this speech. After Putin delivers his speech,
why?
After we're talking about trying to improve relations between Russia, and we have this, like, let's all hold hands and sing kumbaya moment that we have this morning, if you waited until tomorrow to release that we're indicting 14 Russian intelligence officials for election meddling, it would suck all of the power out of today's events. By releasing that last week, it becomes last week's news. People are going to talk about it still. We're going to address it. But it's still last week's news, and there's a 24-hour news cycle that ensures we have a short memory. If you release that same indictment list tomorrow, that becomes this week's news instead of the meeting. This meeting becomes colored by that announcement.
So you can't win either way.
In all honesty, I think you probably couldn't win. And you could, and I'm sure you would have people accusing them of waiting until after the meeting, just like I'm sure you'll have people accusing them of announcing it just prior to the meeting.
I don't think
that there's a way to win.
I think that's fair. I think if we had a full up round attorney general who picks up the phone and calls the president and says, "Hey, boss, this indictment's coming down. This is what I'm thinking. I just wanted to call you and get your thoughts on it." I think that, I don't know. To me, it was curious, but I can see you can make a case. You can make a case either way. Who gets more out of this the quote unquote summit, Putin or Trump?
You know, I really don't like qualifying things like that because when it comes to international politics, when it comes to diplomacy, everything is slow and most of everything is meaningless when it comes to heads of state. You know, every day Americans and Russians are interacting to some extent, whether it's on the deconflict line in Syria or some degree like that. Relations between Russia and the United States are developing constantly. When we have these heads of state get together and talk, they're going to talk about all the stuff that we've been talking about for the last year. Nothing's really going to come of that discussion. Putin wants to help America determine whether or not Russia meddled with the election.
Clearly, that was the best part of the whole of both initial statements. We will, if you submit the evidence to us, we will be happy to investigate it. So we would like to work with you on this.
Yeah. It's just like Trump meeting with Kim. You know, everybody's like, "Oh, this will either determine war or peace." No, what it is it's the first meeting that's going to be followed up by lesser known officials meeting for months to years. There may be some subtle changes between our two nations. There may be some policy changes, but ultimately it's going to be a really slow progression toward either war or peace. People want to believe that problems are solved in one 90-minute conversation. I think they actually went 2 hours and 11. That's not really how problems are solved, especially at the national level. The problems are too big. There are too many people involved. You don't solve it in a meeting like this. What you do is you get the ball rolling. You establish a tenor for the rest of the conversation. So I don't think that I can effectively say either country left as a winner here. However, that said, Putin came off as the leader who is seeking peace. If you just look at his remarks in a vacuum, if you're not aware of current Russian foreign policy, Putin, I would argue, probably did come off better. Trump, you know, he again referenced American domestic politics, you know, and American media as a problem that he's got to contend with. And he would rather seek peace than try to mitigate the Democrats or the horrible media. It made him, on the global stage, that sounds like he's worried about petty shit.
Right.
You know?
I agree.
Now,
I understand, domestically,
it's a big deal.
I know the same thing. My own opinion is that Putin gets more out of it because, again, what he's trying to reassert is Russian greatness, right? The Cold War ended because Russia's economy could no longer sustain its commitment to its military. And it was crumbling, right? So when your economy is
glass notes and other things played a role in that, but that ball started rolling because they couldn't keep up spending-wise.
Right. I mean, if you looked at their ships and ports rusting and things like that, I mean, what you saw was the decay and the rotting of the Soviet Union. And so, I think that Putin comes off better and he needs to because he comes off as a powerful world leader and that enhances him because he is playing a shell game. Again, think about it. He's the leader of a country whose economy is smaller than Canada's. Okay? He's minuscule. And yet he's walking around.
100% right.
He's walking around with his puffed out chest. They cannot sustain their commitment in Syria. Okay? They're faking that. So Russia is a con game. But I'll tell you what.
I will put a caveat on that con game. Russia is very good at choosing defense initiatives that give them a big bang for the ruble.
I agree.
You know, ICBMs, nuclear weapons, things like that, that force them to be a force to reckon with. Even though you know they couldn't sustain a war with the United States, you know that they could do a terrible amount of damage. And that's enough to get them a seat at the table, you know? So I agree. They couldn't sustain an actual war. I mean, the thing that's protecting the Baltics, for instance, people are worried about NATO defense. Russia's economy is a much stronger deterrent to war with NATO than any NATO forces along Europe's eastern flank. You know? Their economy is really what stops them from doing more. However, they're still dangerous. You know? They've demonstrated a propensity to do things like using a nerve agent on UK soil that forces you to acknowledge them as a threat, even though, honestly, they're not peers. They're not even close to peers.
Well, in fact, it's interesting, because I'll amplify what you say. We should be disagreeing, but we won't. They are more formidable in operations short of war. And what would those be?
Yes.
Destabilizing, using the American media to come across as they had this big impact on the election, when they probably didn't. Cyber operations. They can sit in little nodes in basements of buildings in Moscow,
We know for a fact that they've infiltrated the U.S. electrical grid that
right.
way. We know for a fact that they have.
And they can at least sow doubt that they can infiltrate America's infrastructure from air traffic control to our electrical grid. So they are a much more formidable power in operations short of war than they are when you say, okay. And I would submit to you this. If Germany simply restored its military to an average European military, there would be no question about whether Russia would behave or not behave. Germany compromises, in my opinion, NATO. They compromise Europe. And Germany is a freeloading weak link with the biggest economy in Europe. And so hopefully at some point, Germany, there's political change there, and everybody gets over World War II, and you take your place as a shareholder and a giver as much as you've been freeloading, and now you're ready to pull your own share of the weight. If that happens, there is no card Russia can play in Europe. They simply could not take, you know, the United States, France, Germany on. They would be annihilated. So to me, Putin exploits that. Exploits that gap in NATO that Germany creates, and so in Operation Short of War, he's at his apex of power, because if somebody walks up and pulls his pants down, everybody goes, oh, the Emperor does have no clothes on, and he ain't all that, but he is master,
it's,
I think.
It's hybrid warfare,
right?
It's hybrid warfare is the doctrine that Russia's employing now, you know, and we see them using the exact same practices on the United States as we saw, to be honest with you, during the annexation of Crimea, you know, in 2014, short of actual kinetic operations, right? So when Russia annexed Crimea, what did they do? They released a media onslaught through Kremlin-owned outlets that said Russia was not in Crimea, right? Okay. This is just separatists. It's Crimean citizens who are fighting for their independence from Ukraine. It was obviously bullshit. Russia sent mercenaries in, which were actually, to be honest with you, likely uniformed conventional troops that were just in plain clothes, to engage in warfare. And then they said to the media that they weren't there. And then they also used social media to really influence people into believing that this really could be a separatist function. Okay, maybe some Russian forces are involved, but they're just there to support the Crimean people. You know, and then they went as far as they literally paid Fred Durst and other U.S. celebrities to move to Crimea after the annexation so that they could try to market Crimea as this Russian utopia that they established after the Crimean people, you know, rose up. It's a bunch of disinformation. It's a bunch of misinformation. with a little bit of kinetic operations. You know, we saw them meddling with the Crimean power grid just as they tried to gain access and successfully gained access to the American power grid. We saw social media manipulation. We saw media disinformation campaigns. This is Russia's modus operandi now. This is how they work. You don't need to be the richest guy in the room. If you've got one hacker who's capable enough to get to infiltrate someone's defenses, it's much easier to infiltrate than it is to defend when it comes to cybersecurity.
And then on the other hand, then on the other hand, you had the Obama administration at the time would not sell any type of effective weapon system from drone to anti-tank missiles to the Ukrainians. Say we support you, don't go there. And then what do? We put our hands in our pockets. So, again,
you could argue he was trying to avoid, you know, a proxy war, the likes of which we now have in Syria to a certain extent. You could argue that, but to be honest with you, hindsight's 2020. Whether you want to argue that or not, he was wrong.
Right.
You know, Crimea, now we're moving slowly towards the world just acknowledging Crimea as a part of Russia at this point. It looks very unlikely to me that this progress for Russia moves backwards.
Oh, no.
You know?
No, let me tell you, why does Russia need Crimea? Well, they need it.
Well, they've got some naval installations there.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? It previously housed nuclear assets. It's a strategic stronghold.
Look at your map.
You know?
You don't need to be a genius to look at Crimea and see Sevastopol and see everything that Russia gave up when it lost the Crimean Peninsula. And what a big deal it is. And so, again, Russia is much more substantial, right, in hybrid war, Operation Shorter War, than they would be. For instance, so the fear is like, well, what will he do if we arm the Ukrainians? Well, what is he going to do? Is he going to invade the Ukraine? It's its own independent country. So, again, the only way you sustain peace in the long term is from positions of strength. Not from positions of weakness, and certainly not from positions of weakness in front of a dictator, right? So you don't heed his
Absolutely.
Warnings. You build up your alliances, you build them up militarily, and you're not afraid because he knows he'll lose. He knows that, you know, and so he plays
and
the game.
That's the most important thing to keep in mind when we're talking about Vladimir Putin. You know, when we talk about Kim Jong-un, people have a tendency to just characterize him as a lunatic.
Right.
He's obviously not a lunatic, or he wouldn't still be in power, and he wouldn't have a nuclear program that's forced Western powers to the table. He might be a little bit unhinged, but he's obviously got some logic and reasoning skills. Putin is all the way over on the other end of the spectrum, where he is a calculating, very intelligent world leader who uses aggression as a weapon. Because, I mean, it's just like that guy in the bar who's actually not very tough, but he's so quick to fly off the handle that people back down constantly.
Right.
Putin uses that same mentality. He's not even a very big guy. But if you watch how he walks, I watched a video months ago about body mechanics. Putin walks like he's carrying a firearm. The same way you see guys in Russian security forces walk when they have, like, you know, a firearm tucked underneath their sport coat. Putin walks like a gunslinger. You know, I mean, you could argue that it's from training because he was FSB, you know. I really don't think that's
no.
the case.
It's all for
show. I've done it work for years and
it's
years.
It's all for show.
And I don't walk like that.
It's all for
exactly,
show.
Exactly. You know?
And again, think about it. Is there anything crazier that you've ever heard in your life than George Bush saying, I've looked into this man's
I looked into his eyes. It's crazy, man. It's I couldn't.
Could you imagine?
I couldn't begin to imagine.
Wow!
You know,
he's a KGB guy, you kook. How could you say that? Even if you thought
there's pictures of Putin dressed as a tourist meeting President Ronald Reagan. He's like the scary kind of KGB.
My God!
You know?
Right? He's not only a Russian, and he's lying because his lips are moving. He's a KGB guy, so he's, like, lying.
There's a solid chance he bombed a Russian apartment building to come to power.
Right.
He killed countless Russian civilians in his pursuit of becoming the president of Russia.
He lies in
We're
his
sleep.
We're not talking
about a good guy.
Yeah, he lies in his sleep. He can't even be honest in his sleep. So, anyway. It's
very likely the richest man on the planet.
Explain that to people. I told that to somebody. I said, look, he's a gangster. He's a dictator. And they're like, well, how could he be the richest guy, the richest guy on the planet? I said, do you know anything about Russia's oil and gas rights?
Exactly. You know, Russia's media isn't the only industry in the nation that's utterly controlled by the government. Just about every profitable enterprise in the Russian nation or in any of their satellites like Kaliningrad and elsewhere, if it's profitable, the Russian government has a hand in it. And I don't mean in like an official and on the level way. You know, it is perhaps the most corrupt global stage government that you're going to find. There may be some more corrupt governments in like tiny little countries that don't have any real sway geopolitically. Russia is a corruption powerhouse. Vladimir Putin's annual salary is less than the American president's. I think it's like 250,000 US, something like that. Don't quote me on that exact figure. But he somehow is always walking around in like track suits that cost $15,000, stuff like that. And you wonder, well, how is it possible that he has all this really nice stuff when according to him, he only makes like 200 grand a year? The way is just about everyone involved in Vladimir Putin's life, his ex-wife, friends of his, are all worth billions of dollars, despite a number of them being professional dancers, painters, things like that. And the reason is because all of this money gets funneled up to the top where Putin just sets it aside. It's not in any of his official holdings because that would show how corrupt he is. He just has control and access over literally billions of dollars. You know, the corruption in the Russian government, it comes from the top and trickles down.
Putin makes $112,000 a year, U.S. He saves, obviously.
I've seen him in clothes that cost that.
Obviously, he manages his money wisely.
Yeah. You know, what the problem that a lot of people have when they think about places like Russia or China being a great example is that we tend to project our own cultural rules, our own laws, onto other cultures and other nations. In the United States, we have a free press. Donald Trump might not always love the free press, but what's important about that free press is that they have the ability to question or challenge the president. You know, if you happen to be a Trump supporter right now, you're probably mad about how the way in which some of the free press is doing it. But it's important that we maintain that tact, right? China and Russia don't have that. So, like in China, for instance, right now there's a message that went out to all of the large China media entities that said, do not talk about the tariffs and the trade war with the United States. It is banned from Chinese domestic media, which means in the news in China, they can't talk about it. Think about how little you would know about what was going on in the world if the government, whether it was run by a guy you liked or a guy you didn't, decided what it was you were allowed to hear about in the news. That's how Russia and China operate. So it gives them carte blanche on doing things like this, on being corrupt, on President Xi appointing himself president for life. They're able to do things like this because the media
That was passed by the Chinese Politburo or whatever they call themselves, Congress, on a vote, I want to say, of like 6,000-2 or something like that. So it was a Democratic vote.
I mean, it's obviously universally supported then. Everybody, you know, China is a democratic utopia.
Thank you.
Of course not.
Thank you.
Jackie Chan is a part of the Chinese parliament. Jackie Chan actively produces pro-China propaganda that is so egregious that even in China, some critics call it propaganda.
What?
You know, here in America, we love Jackie Chan because we're like, oh man, Rumble in the Bronx. Jackie Chan is an outspoken critic of the United States anytime that he's not touring to present a movie to the United States. Jackie Chan regularly produces propaganda films for the Chinese government, notably ones that are directed at like the Indian markets and things like that, to try to bolster efforts like the Silk Road Initiative and things like that. Movies that Jackie Chan has played in, has starred in or produced have been banned from some foreign theaters because of the propaganda element to it. China doesn't just control their news media. They control the media.
Do you blame Jackie Chan for doing that, given his popularity in China and all he's doing is making a buck? He's the ultimate capitalist. Okay, look, Jackie, we can get this amount of money out of this film, but you know, you can't, you gotta be into the party line, okay? right.
And, well, you know, while Jackie Chan was touring in China,
he is an actor, after all.
Orca. He is. He said specifically, this may not be verbatim, but it's close, that too much freedom is bad for a society. Too much individual freedom makes people lose sight of the importance of the nation as a whole. So he supports the idea of limiting people's freedom of speech, for instance, on social media, where there's a lot of censorship in China.
Yeah, but
he only does that
to make a buck. Can we not respect that?
I'm going to be honest with you. I can't respect that.
Okay.
If you offered me millions of dollars, I would not go on tour touting the idea of reducing the American citizens' individual freedoms.
Okay, how about if I offered you hundreds of millions of dollars?
You know, I'm going to be honest, I still wouldn't do it.
You wouldn't do it? You would be free.
No.
You would be able to come and go out of this place that you're going to get all this money. You would be making hundreds of millions, billions, as Dr. Evil would say, and you would turn that money down. I just see Jackie Chan as a whore, you know?
You know, maybe he is. I still want to respect that. And the way I can tell you, maybe I would question it if I'm looking at $100 million, you know, under a mattress.
Right.
I could make more money than I make now pursuing other lines of work. I do what I do because I love it, you know. I can't get behind the idea of giving someone a free pass for touting the company line when the company line is the bad guy narrative.
Is evil.
I can't give you a free pass just because you're trying to get paid.
Okay.
You know,
I
extend that logic to justifying anything.
I respect that, but I'm imagining Jackie Chan, you know, in someplace outside of China, drinking with his friends from Hollywood and stuff like that, and them talking about the money he makes in China. And he's like, dude, it's crazy. It's a cash machine like you have never even seen. And then somebody says, yeah, but what about that shit you talk about the United States? He goes, come on, man. It's like, is it any different than when they turn on a camera in Iraq and they say death to the United States and the camera goes off and then they talk about, okay, can we get back to talk about the water project that guy's making money off of? You know, is it any different than that? No. Come on, man. I'm a businessman.
Even if it's not different, why does that make it okay? Why does that make it justifiable? When other people, see, this is like whataboutism. You know, when other people do bad shit, so we go, yeah, but this bad shit that I'm doing is not as bad as that bad shit. It's still bad shit, man. You know, like, so.
I'm trying to find a way to respect Jackie Chan, and you're not helping me out at all.
I'm telling you, man, Jackie Chan and Steven Seagal, they turned on us. You know, back in the 80s and the 90s, we were all about these guys. Now Steven Seagal lives in Russia and talks all the time about how we need to support Russia in American foreign policy. And Jackie Chan lives in China and talks all the time about how America is the root cause of all the world's evils.
It dried up on Steven Seagal. How is he going to maintain the franchise if he doesn't go do that? People stop buying.
It's like he could do some sit-ups and get a gym membership, and then he wouldn't be too fat to be in movies anymore.
Okay,
you know?
So, all right, we got 2 minutes. What's going to come out of, is this going to be like the meeting with North Korea? Is this going to be the first step? And is that what we're going to hear? This is simply a first cosmetic step. In terms of seeing if the United States and Russia in some way, shape, or form can cooperate together. Is that what this dance is about?
I do think that it's a cosmetic step.
Right.
I don't think that the conclusion is in any way solidified. Because really, what's going to determine this isn't really going to be American policy. All of America's policies towards Russia are reactionary. We placed sanctions because of the annexation of Crimea. We sanctioned individuals because of their efforts in cyber warfare against the United States. None of the sanctions we have in place over Russia, none of our policies towards Russia are first strike policies. They're all retaliatory, right? So what's really going to determine the way Russia and the United States interact moving forward is going to be Russia's behavior. And to be honest with you, I don't see them changing things. They've got no reason to. The things that they've been doing have been working. They've been successful. Russia is more dominant geopolitically than it has been in decades. You know, despite the fact that they don't have the economy to support it, they don't have the military to support it, but they have the reputation to support it.
That's,
if we don't see a change in Russia, we won't see a change in our relationship.
That's pretty
optimistic. And I doubt we'll see a change in Russia.
That's pretty optimistic. That is the same way that, you know, that the Chinese have looked at the United States. Look, you know, we'll do what we want. Hopefully the Americans will give us what we want. They'll make strongly worded statements and not do anything as we announce the nine dash line, as we begin to fortify islands, because they're engaged in other stuff. And ultimately they won't confront us because it's not the way they do it. So,
absolutely.
So we'll do what we want, and we really don't care what they say. When we go through rocky periods of time, we'll weather those, certainly. But it is interesting.
Well,
I will say this.
It is
interesting, though, that he announced, tariffs on $200 billion more. That means we're on the way to we're gonna burn this down a little bit on you guys. We want this thing to change, which is kind of interesting. I also had a guy, Grant Newsham, on, and I said, hey, Mattis went to China. Not too much written about it. What do you make of it? He said, well, I think the reason there wasn't much written about, and it was kept to President Xi says that their claims to the South China Sea are legitimate, are, for once, the Americans went there and stood on their hind legs and said, we're not changing anything. We will not stop moving through the South China Sea because you've illegally annexed it. And just know this. We are not backing up. We're not changing anything. He said, and I think that people took a little bit of notice that there was no statement coming out of the Mattis Xi forum saying that we've agreed on new things, which meant the United States didn't agree on anything and didn't concede anything, which in and of itself is a revolution. So, I don't know.
You know, I've got two progressively more tinfoil hat laden theories about that.
Okay.
And that agree with that. The first is, Mattis is a pretty careful speaker. So when Mattis goes to these foreign nations, particularly ones that are kind of diplomatically competitors like China, he chooses his words carefully, and he doesn't allot for fiery headlines that draw lots of traffic, you know, and I don't just mean traffic
Agreed.
In terms of clicks,
no.
I mean in terms of views on television.
You're spot on.
You know, so when Mattis goes and is eloquent and articulate, voices the American position without seeming argumentative, you know, he just says, this is what we'll do, and that's what we'll do. And China says, this is what we'll do. There's no bomb to drop, so people just don't cover it. My even more tinfoil hat related theory is that China owns a huge amount of American media. You know, I mean, China's got billions of dollars invested in news outlets and parent companies of news outlets, movie studios, things like that. China exercises a great deal of influence in how the movies Hollywood produces are made. So the fact that we know that for a fact always makes me a little suspicious about how we cover China at large. When I know they've got billions of dollars in the media machine already invested in the United States, I have to worry about how those billions of dollars could skew coverage.
Whoa.
I'm not saying that China's a part of a big deep state conspiracy.
It sounds like you just did that.
What I am saying, though, is that when you know someone's signature is on your check, they're a little bit more reluctant to paint them as the bad guy. China is very much more the boogeyman in today's Cold War, if you want to call it that, than Russia is. China's a much larger threat to us militarily, diplomatically, economically. But we treat China like they're probably a good guy over there. They're not. President Xi is just as bad a guy as Putin. He's just a much more polished and deliberate one who tries to convey the image of a good guy. You know, to be honest with you, I think that there's a lot more at play with American perceptions of China than we take into account. But starting with how movies like Transformers are filmed, they have exercised influence on changing the scenes in those movies. If they can do that, I wonder what else they can do.
It is pretty creepy. But again, it's business. And they do it to everybody. Do you want access to, you know, are
the second largest market in the world when it comes to movies and television?
Here's what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to change these scenes.
Exactly.
You want access to our market? You're going to have to move your company here, and it's going to have to partner with this, and they're going to have to know your secrets. They're gangs.
You know, and if you want to see a way that that's affecting our lives right now, if you want to see a real world example of that, look at the slew of action movies, CGI heavy action movies that have come out in the past 5 years that have performed okay or not very well and gotten terrible critical reviews in the United States. but still turned a profit. You know, movies like Rampage. I love Dwayne Johnson. Rampage is a good example of movies that didn't do stellar here in the domestic market, but made hundreds of millions of dollars in the Chinese market. And part of that is because they tailored these movies specifically to, all right, we're going to get at least $300 or $400 million in the U.S. market. We're going to get at least another $300 million in the Chinese market. If you pull that Chinese market out of the equation, these movies don't make money anymore, you know? So they have to tailor these movies to get past Chinese governmental censors. America doesn't have governmental censors. The MPAA is just a private organization that's got their own problems. You don't have to get a rating in the United States. In China, if it doesn't pass their censors, it doesn't get released in their country.
All right.
So the censors will come back and say, hey, do this.
All right, I'm done with you. The fastest 1 hour in radio. All right, tell me, tell everybody, where can they find your work?
Well, you can always find me on SoftRep.com. If you're looking for me, just put a /authors/AlecHollings. You can find me on Facebook. It's Facebook.com/AlecHollingsWriter. You can find me on Twitter at Twitter @AlecHollings52. And if you're looking for just my fitness stuff, you can find me at Facebook.com/OMFAlex for Old Man Fitness.
There you have it. The one and only Alex Hollings. All right, bud. Thank you very much. I appreciate it as always. We'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Always a pleasure, man. Catch you later.
There you have it. Alex Hollings. He of SoftRep. As I told him a little bit ago, easiest guy in the world to fill up an hour with, Alex Hollings. More Ballmarine Radio. Gunner coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.